Hey there, Danny with Right Foot Down. I messed up this ad read so many times because I really want to tell you about Track Monkey Apparel. They make great quality, enthusiast shirts along with hats, stickers, watches, patches, you name it. A couple of my personal favorites are their Life is Better at the Track tee and their One Track Mind tee. You should really check them out and see for yourself. Their products are great for you or the gearhead in your life. Visit trackmonkeyapparel.com.
You're listening to the Untitled Car Show in partnership with RightFootDown.com. Visit RightFootDown for your daily automotive fix. If you enjoyed today's program, please tell a friend. It's the best way to support this show. If you want to visit the archives, go to YouTube and search for Untitled Car Show. That'll bring you to the archived episodes. If you want to follow the show, just search for Untitled Car Show on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can always send an email to the show at untitledcarshow@rightfootdown.com. We're so glad you decided to spend the next hour or so with us. Without further ado, let's get into today's program. Hello and welcome to the Untitled Car Show. Today I have the deputy editor from Road and Track, Bob Sorkonich. He is an interesting gentleman with an unusual dislike of podcasts. Bob, how are you doing this evening?
I'm good, Ike. Thanks for having me on.
No, it's I'm joking a little bit. The way we kind of got you on is an offhanded comment you made on the Twitter, and then, of course, we had to drag you into it. So I'm curious, from the get-go, like, what is your day-to-day job over there with Road and Track?
So I am, my title is Deputy Online Editor. So I do most of my work for the website, and that means writing articles, reviewing cars, doing news, also editing other people's articles, whether it's staff writers or freelancers. And I also pretty regularly have items that go into the print magazine. So I mostly do car reviews and a little bit of news. And then, you know, sometimes I just write about whatever comes to mind regarding cars.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, it runs the gambit. Like this week you did a bunch of coverage out there in Detroit because that's kind of the talk of the town in the automotive press. But it's been reviews and everything. So like what is... like, where does that passion come from? Like, because it's, you're one of the few people where I really can't sit down and nail, like, you know, what your favorite type of car is, what your favorite type of, you know, driving or sport or article is. I really can't pick one out and go, like, oh, that's definitely, you know, something Bob loves to do more than go off and do something else. So, which I think is a blessing in this day and age because there's a bunch of people where it's like, well, that person just likes that because that's just their cup of tea, and they just kind of pursue down that line of thought. So I guess that's kind of a multi-tiered question, so let's make it a little bit easier for you, too. Do you actually have a favorite type of article to write or do?
I really love doing articles where you can do something unusual. So, you know, there is your typical car review. There is your typical news item. You know, there's basic stuff that if you've read enough of them, you can pretty well predict how a new one is going to look. I like the stuff that's unusual. So whether that means reviewing a car that other people haven't reviewed or doing something with a car that is a little bit out of the ordinary or meeting somebody really interesting who has a fascinating story to tell, what I really aim to do in everything that I write is to have you come to the end of the article and go, wow, I didn't expect this to happen this way. You know, I didn't expect to learn this story or get to know this person or, you know, feel like I was there experiencing this unusual event. I try and do a little bit of a surprise, you know, and that can take a lot of different forms, but really the stuff that I love is the stuff that comes out differently from what you might typically expect or what I might expect when I'm going into, you know, beginning to write an article. I just like a little bit of a surprise.
I get that. That makes sense because it's humdrum. That's the word I was looking for. A little humdrum if you're just doing the same thing and there's no... You're the Shyamalan of the automotive world, I guess. Like, you want a twist.
Exactly. I'm always going for the, and he was dead the entire time. You know, that sort of wow.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what's a twist? So, before we go and get too deep into, you know, your backstory and your history, which I am fascinated to find out more about because you got such an interesting one, I always like to try and start off with these, I call them the Inside the Actors Studios questions. It's, you know, these are, you know, a lot of questions. Like the first question we ask, it's just your answer today because we're all car guys and gals out there and we all, you know, it could change day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute. So this is just as you kind of sit, you know, here today as we speak. So what's your favorite car?
As of right now, my favorite car today is probably the Corvette Grand Sport. Just a perfect combination of a car that's quick, sharp handling, fun to drive, and, you know, accessible. It's not a Lamborghini. It's not a Ferrari. It's a car that you know a normal person might have hope of someday owning. I really love the whole Corvette line, and the Grand Sport is the sweetheart of the lineup in my view.
Mm-hmm. Very shark looking. Every time I look at one of those things, for whatever reason.
Absolutely.
What is your least favorite car?
Ooh, that's a good question. Least favorite car, I would have to say, is probably the Mitsubishi Outlander Sport. Simply because that's a car that still exists for some reason, and it's like they've given up trying. You know, it's not a car that I hate. It's a car that I'm disappointed in. I'm disappointed that they haven't done something unusual or innovative with it, because Mitsubishi used to be an exciting company. They used to do cool and interesting things, and now it just sort of feels like they've given up with a shrug, and that car embodies that for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Mitsubishi gets a lot of hate in this category. I was half expecting the Mirage, because that's a typical answer from a lot of people. but there does seem to be something, you know, hate would mean that there was an emotion attached to it, whereas at least it inspires something in you, whereas it's just kind of like, Billy, you're better than this. You were an A-plus student in high school. Now you've dropped out of college and you're just smoking weed in your parents' basement. Like, I know you can do better.
Exactly.
Just come on. Yeah.
Exactly.
So what is your – what modification trend? So we're talking about, you know, Brodozer, Stance, you know, Rat Rod, whatever, that you find yourself, maybe that you don't want to do to your own car, but you find yourself attracted to.
I really love the ridiculousness of donks. You know, old American boxy sedans jacked up on 30-inch wheels. I love the gregariousness of it. I love the outrageousness of it. I love the fact that when you see these cars, people aren't doing this to fit into some sort of paradigm of performance. You know, a lot of the modifications you see on cars are meant to evoke a look of performance. You know, when people lower their cars, when they put wider tires on their cars, big spoilers, even if none of this stuff actually creates better performance, it's rooted in a look that came from motorsports. And the donk and box and bubble cars go completely in the opposite direction from that. And I love it because they're not pretending to be race cars. They're just going for sheer ostentatiousness. And I don't know if I could pull one off. I don't know, you know, if I would have sort of the chutzpah to drive around in one. but whenever I see one, I love it.
My favorite is when you see them driving around in, like, floods, and it's like, see who's laughing now. Like, that's the one time the donk really comes into its own in terms of quote-unquote performance.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what, then, is your least favorite automotive trend? You see someone did it to their own vehicle, and you're like, come on, like, why did you do that?
This is a recent thing for me, but I'm really starting to dislike fake patina. And so you see a lot of this, especially at hot rod shows and muscle car shows, where people will, you know, they'll have an old pickup truck and they'll paint old lettering on the side of it to make it look like it was a company truck 50 years ago and it's never been repainted. And you go up and ask them and they say, oh, yeah, I paid a guy to do that. He specializes in old stencil design. Or the people who, you know, will build a car from catalog parts and then leave the body in bare metal so it rusts and makes it look like it's been sitting in the desert for 70 years. I started out liking this trend, and it's an offshoot of Rat Rod. It's an offshoot of, you know, it was a reaction to the 90s when hot rod shows were all about billet and chrome and, you know, paint that was 60 layers deep. It was a reaction to that, but now it's almost become a farce, and it just feels insincere to paint a car or to decorate a car to make it look like it's been neglected. I used to love the look, but now it's become so commonplace and so fake that it's jarring me.
Yeah. Now, there's the one thing I think across the board in all automotive enthusiasm that everyone can get behind is, as long as you're not lying to us, we're fine with it. But, like, the moment you try and, like, fake us out a little bit too much, that's why people don't like the fake hood scoops and all that stuff. It's like, the moment you're sitting there and you're lying to us, and we know you're lying, it's over. Like, it just doesn't work anymore. So
exactly. And that's true of the automakers as well, you know? I mean, whenever I see a factory car with a fake hood scoop or, you know, painted materials that make it look like carbon fiber, stuff like that, it's just, it attracts more attention when you have something fake and non-functional than if it just was not there.
Yep. Shelby.
Among others.
Yeah. Granddaddy of it all, though. So what is the car you dread being stuck behind at a red light?
Oh, that's a good question. So living in New York City, I get caught behind taxi cabs a lot. And for the most part, that's okay, because taxi drivers, as crazy as they are, they're crazy like a fox. You know, they're looking for every opening in traffic. I think they're the best and craziest drivers on the road. But having said that, most of the taxi cabs on the road in New York are hybrid. They're either Prius or Camry hybrid or Ford Escape hybrid. So when you get caught behind an old, haggard Crown Victoria, you know as soon as that thing pulls away, you're going to get just mosquito-fogged in blue smoke, because they've all got piston knock, and they've all, you know, they're all running along on a half a set of main bearings, and you just know you're going to get choked out as soon as that guy hits the gas.
Yep. Like, it takes a quart of oil every time you fill it up. Like, that's just how it works.
Exactly. And I feel bad saying that, because when I do occasionally catch a cab that is a Ford Crown Vic, it's like visiting a long-lost uncle, you know? It's such a nostalgic feeling. And the cabbies I talk to, they all love the old Crown Vics. The guys that have been driving long enough to remember the Crown Vics, they all pine for them. But, you know, you'd rather be in the back seat as opposed to being in the car directly behind, because, you know, that light turns green and you can't roll your windows up fast enough.
Exactly. Like, I thought we were in New York, not in New Jersey. This is ridiculous. So, what automotive sound or noise do you love?
I have always loved the sound of a straight-six engine. When I was growing up, for a long period of time, actually, both of my parents drove cars with straight-sixes. My dad had a Mercedes with a straight-six, and my mom had a Jeep Cherokee with a straight six. And there is just something so inherently smooth and almost sporty sounding about nearly any straight six. Most four cylinders sound like garbage. There are V8s that sound better than others. But by and large, a straight six sounds good, you know? And you think back to the sound of James Bond's Aston Martin from Goldfinger, and that's, you know, every straight six has that sound buried somewhere inside of it, just dying to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, just as a general engine layout, a straight six makes sweet music in my ears.
Well, good, we can be friends, because I have a straight six. So,
ooh, what do you got?
Well, so this is where you start to realize how nutty I am. I have a Chevy 250 that's in a 1991 Volvo station wagon.
That's quite the combo.
Yeah, and it has a transmission that was a three on the tree, but now it's three on the floor. So, it's not 100% working yet because it's my, you know, garage engineering, but we're getting there. The neighbors don't like the sound of the straight six because right now it's just manifolds. But
yeah, the neighbors a mile away can hear that thing, can't they?
Yeah, they definitely can. Yeah, when I first got it started up, it's ridiculous.
So what on earth prompted this swap? It's probably the only one in the world.
Yeah, I hope so. So I'll give you the short version of the story. So I've owned the Volvo wagon for a while, and it was always just kind of my runaround, like, I need to take shit to the, scrapyard, you know, do projects, you know. I just take stuff to and from in an old crappy wagon because I like old crappy wagons. But it was used and abused, so I figured, well, but it works, so we'll take it on the 24 Hours of Lemons Road Rally. And we made it roughly, I think we calculated it out, like with all the back roads and everything, about 1,000 miles before it blew out the electrical system. So you hauled it back to my house, and I went, you know what this car needs? Is it needs an engine swap. So it's been first I tried putting a Nissan motor in that, and then I messed that up, and then I tried putting an Audi 5000 motor, and then I messed that up. So now the Chevy straight six, it's like, you know, simple, stupid engineering, and this is kind of an awesome motor, and it came out of a Nova and only has like 34,000 miles on it. So,
wow.
Yeah, why not?
Well, when it's done, it will be the only straight six, three-speed, on the tree, on the floor Volvo in the world.
Yep. It's unique and stupid, just like myself. That's the way I like to look at it.
Like, I love it.
Like, why would you do this? Yeah, I don't know. So what automotive sound or noise do you hate?
Ooh. There are a lot of them. But I think the one that instills an immediate visceral reaction in me is when you start hearing sounds that are harbingers of an immediate engine failure. So rod knock, piston slap, valve lifters that go from just a quiet ticking to a real loud clatter. Stuff that says, maybe I should have been paying attention to that oil light for the last 5,000 miles.
It says check engine. It's still there. What's going on?
I checked. It was there. I kept driving.
Exactly. What profession in the automotive world besides your own would you like to try?
I've always been fascinated by what it must be like to be a development driver for an automaker. So, you know, the guys that the people that spend, you know, 70,000 miles driving on washboard road test suspension, or, you know, the durability folks that go out and drive on an oval for, you know, for 5 days straight. I think it's probably a job that, like any other job, can get boring after a while, but being paid to find the weak points in a car that's not hit production yet, I think would be absolutely fascinating, because think of the influence that these professionals exert on the car that finally gets made, somewhere, you know, early on down the line in the development of every car that's on the road today, somebody came back from a field test and said, this is going wrong with the car and here's how we need to fix it. And that, you know, that decision was made hundreds of times for every car that's on the road today, and I just think that's so fascinating that one person could have an effect on a car like that, who isn't a CEO or a head designer or, you know, a crash compliance engineer.
Yeah. Well, I saw, randomly, I saw an opening at Lincoln Motor Company. This is like a few years ago. And one of the things, it was a development driver, and one of the things they wanted was you had to pass a hearing test that basically proved you had excellent hearing, which I thought was fascinating. Uh-huh. Like, it makes sense when you think about it. Like, well, you have to have fantastic hearing. But they're like, don't you have sensors? No, nothing replaces the human ear, I guess. So.
Yeah, and it's not something that you would first think of. You know, you would expect the job requirements to be that, you know, you understood the basic engineering of the car. You understood the demands that would be placed on the car. But, yeah, that's the kind of thing. And it's a fascinating thing because that's at the heart of why we love cars. Is I think people who love cars are much more inclined to have a sense, a mechanical sense, almost like a feel for mechanical machinery. And a lot of that is down to, you know, can you tell that something is not running right just based on the sound that it's making?
Mm-hmm. Or that,
or you know, just the feel for it.
Yeah, like just that little feeling on the back of your neck, like something's not right, and I don't know, I can't put it into words, but I just know she's hurting.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just keep driving anyway because that's what you do. So what profession in the automotive world would you least want to do?
I think the least rewarding, most painful job in the car industry has to be the person who decides that warranty work is denied and has to tell the owner that, because you know that person, when they're delivering that bad news, never gets a good response from anybody.
No.
And you know, there's usually when you're involved in a pretty heated argument about whether something should be covered by warranty or not, the dealership kicks you up the chain to some regional manager, and that person says yes or no. And when they say yes, it's, you know, when they say yes, we'll cover this under warranty, even that's not good news, because the owner is still mad that the car is broken. And when they say no, we can't cover this under warranty, ooh, imagine the verbal abuse and tirades that that person receives every single day that they report for work. That's got to be thankless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would give me a drinking problem within about 3 days, I think. Like.
Exactly. And most of us get into an automotive job because we love cars in one way, shape, or form. And that job, there's no love for cars, because all you're doing is dealing with cars when they fail. You know, that's like, I don't know, it's thankless is the only word I can think of for it.
Mm-hmm. I love people, so I became a hospice worker. Like, no, like, that's not how that works. Like, like, it kind of makes a little bit of sense, but, like, you're basically just putting people down. I mean, like
yeah. It's very similar.
Yeah. So what is the, and I think this is the most important question basically to be asked on any automotive show ever, maybe any program ever, and this was in our prepared notes here. So what is the hardest food to eat while driving?
I've thought long and hard about this, and I think I can say from personal experience that it's got to be lo mein.
That's a good one. That's up there. Lo mein is pretty difficult.
And especially, so I have actually attempted this in the bad decision days of my early driving career. And I will say, in general, chopsticks, I think, are a far superior utensil to the fork, because mm-hmm. you don't need to stab, you can pinch.
Yep.
And that's crucial when you've got a you know, a takeout tray of lo mein in your lap while you're driving. That's not a great scenario to be stabbing or twirling a fork.
Mm-hmm.
The downside is eating lo mein, and eating with chopsticks in general, I think of it as a two-handed job, because you have to hold the vessel and you have to hold the chopsticks. That doesn't leave a lot of arms for driving. So if you ever see somebody eating lo mein while they're driving, stay far away from them. Get off the highway. You know, turn, pull a U-turn. Do whatever you can to get away from them.
So this segment typically devolves into stupid shit Ike's done while driving. So about 6 months, maybe a year ago now. Yeah, about a year ago now. The wife decided on the way home we were going to stop in Indiana and have Chinese food. So going from Chicago to Maryland. And so I went, oh, okay. And I got lo mein. I got the chopsticks. And I got into the manual shift Fiesta ST and drove on the turnpike with lo mein and eat it. It is difficult. It's up there. I think the
so you can attest to this personally.
Oh yeah, no, this is like I'll have some lo mein, and it took forever to come because Chinese place in Indiana. I'm like, I just grab it and let's go. My wife's like, how are you going to eat that while you drive? I'm like, because I'm a professional. That's how I'm going to eat it while driving. So, so I mean, I just remember being like, I don't have the little like sticky thing for the toll. So at one point, I had the chopsticks. I'm slowing down for the toll. And the lo mein in one hand, and I got the toll reader like out and like on the windshield with the other hand, and I just like saw like the look of disgust on my wife's face out of the side. So that's a good one. I'm gonna put that up there.
That's a moment right there.
Yeah, that's how you know she loves you, because it wasn't like I'm divorcing you. It was just the look of I'm disgusted by you. I think she was a little impressed.
Sometimes revulsion and impressed look similar on the face.
Mm. Well, my wife must be impressed with me all the time then. So, so then, what's the hardest makeup to apply while driving?
Not speaking with experience, I'm going to have to say it's eyeshadow. Anything around the eyes, I would imagine, is hard. Because you know, if you're putting makeup on your lips or on your cheeks, like you can kind of do that by feel. But anything around the eyes, you really need to be looking in the mirror, and you have an implement in your hand that if you miscalculate even slightly, it's going directly into your old eye hole. But the eyeshadow thing in particular is, I think, the trickiest, because not only are you working on your eyes, so you need the mirror. You're closing your eye to apply it.
Mm.
So, you know, I think eyeliner and mascara is up there, but eyeshadow, I think, takes the cake.
That's a good point.
And I say this, you know, as when I ride the subway in the morning, I watch people putting on makeup on the subway, and I think, God, that's got to be impossible. But doing it in a car where you've got bumps and potholes and, you know, you're often swerving, you know, making pretty quick maneuvers, that seems particularly dicey to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the number one had been eyeliner, just because of the threat of impaling your eyeball. But the eyeshadow, we're moving you up to number one. These are some great A answers here, sir. This is why you make the big bucks over there with the road and track.
you have to for my eyeshadow opinion.
That's right, yeah. See, it's all connected. Like, I knew there'd be good answers with this. The closing the eyeball, that you lose a lot of peripheral vision, and you lose, you know, the ability to sense depth. This is good, but you're still in the eye area, so damage is going to be crazy bad. So we got one more question, and then we'll get into your history here. But I got two cars for you. One of these cars you have to live with the way it's modified for the rest of your life, as your daily driver. All right. So one of the cars is a Mitsubishi Outlander Sport, but it's been modified and turned into a donk. The other one, we'll go with, because they always have a theme on them. So we'll go with, you like peanut M&Ms? Ooh, no, it's a lo mein donk. So it's a lo mein Mitsubishi Outlander Sport donk.
Which is a theme I don't think I've ever seen done on a donk before.
No. Like, well, it's like ramen, basically, right? Like lo mein, like ramen, something. I don't know. We'll work out the details if you pick it. And the other one is a Corvette Grand Sport, but it's 100%, and this makes it extra worse, covered in that fake rust patina, which is extra bad because car is actually fiberglass.
That's especially bad because it's a composite body.
Yep.
Oh, this is just painful to think about. Ooh. Oh, man. So I have to pick one?
You have to pick one. That's your car. that's what you drive for the rest
for
of your life.
For the rest of my days.
Yep.
This is a tricky one, man. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to go with the Corvette simply because you're still driving a Corvette. And as goofy as it looks... So this is the thing. I hate the fake patina trend, but doing it on a composite-bodied Corvette, I think, is a great way to lampoon this trend, you know? It's like, how much more fake can fake rust get than putting it on a car that's made out of fiberglass?
So you're like...
So what I'm doing is I'm taking back ownership of this car that you constructed solely to insult my taste.
So you're doing the whole hipster trend with it. Like, nah, I do it ironically, I swear. So
exactly. I like it because it's bad.
Well, that works, I guess. So, yeah, I would have gone with a low main donk just because I think that'd be hilarious. But
it is compelling. I mean, it's a really, like, the more that I think about it, the more fantastic it seems, especially because a lot of the donks that you see out there, you know, a lot of them have spoke wheels, but now they have the wheels that are solid flat faced. So, like, you could paint them up to look like water chestnuts or bamboo shoots or, you know, any of a million ingredients that you could put in your lo mein, mushroom caps. You know, it's the possibilities are endless. And just thinking about going into a vinyl wrap shop and saying, yes, I would like my car wrapped in lo mein, please, that's pretty delightful. It's a tough call, but, I mean, if I'm going to be driving it, it's going to be the rusty Corvette.
Well, I think you made a good choice there. Well, I think that kind of proves your, car enthusiast bona fides. Like, so let's kind of get into your history here. So I'm fascinated. So you have, you're over there working Road and Track now, but you seem to have worked basically everywhere in the car world before kind of ending over there with Road and Track. Can you tell us how you started in the industry and how you got to where you are now?
So it's a long and winding road, Ike. I actually started out in medical school. I went to college for biochemistry, and I thought I wanted to be a physician, so I went into medical school. And after 2 years of medical school, I came to the slow but growing realization that I did not want to be a doctor. I didn't want to practice medicine. So I left, and I worked a lot of random jobs, and I had always been writing on the side for fun. So it took me about 2 years of applying to jobs and getting jobs that I had no interest in to realize that I liked writing more than anything else I was doing. So I took an internship with Gizmodo, which is what brought me to New York. I moved to New York for that job. And the internship turned into a staff writer position, and I spent 2 years at Gizmodo basically writing about technology in general, doing cell phone and laptop reviews, writing about science and technology and engineering, and I was loving my job at Gizmodo. I was writing about stuff that I really enjoyed, and out of the blue, I got a LinkedIn message from Hearst, which owns Road and Track and Car and Driver, and they were looking for an automotive web writer based in New York City, and it was just pure coincidence that I checked my LinkedIn messages the day that this recruiter sent out the message, and I came in, and I had been reading Road and Track and Car and Driver since I was like 8 years old. And so I came in for the interview and started out as basically just a blogger, a news writer for Road and Track and Car and Driver. And I've been here since October of 2014. After about a year, I went full-time to Road and Track. I left my duties at Car and Driver. And as I've been here, my responsibilities grew from just writing quick blog posts for the website to reviewing cars, covering motorsports, and most recently, as of about a year ago, I've started having work appear in the print magazine as well. So it all sort of fell into my lap, you know, just by the random blessing of a LinkedIn message. So, yeah, and, you know, I look back now and I think to myself what life would be like if I was a physician, you know, working in a doctor's office every day, and that person is unrecognizable to me.
Like, no one said there'd be blood. Like, what, 2 years of this, it's been nothing but blood. I don't know what's going on. You know, I'm out of here. So you obviously then have a background, if you were able to go from, you know, writing about technology to writing about cars in the automotive field, did that come from, were you born into it, or was this something you discovered when you were a little kid?
So I have always been interested in cars. It feels like since birth. I was not born into a supercar enthusiast family. My parents grew up in the 60s and 70s, and so they were into cars as a part of the culture of the era. You know, my dad owned a few sports cars. He owned a Mazda RX-7 when I was born, and my mom had a Camaro that she brought me home from the hospital in. So, you know, both of them were car enthusiasts in the sense that they recognized cool cars when they saw them, and they owned a lot of cool cars. But my dad was not the kind of person who worked on his own car. You know, racing was not a big part of my family life. And so my parents were kind of perplexed that I was so into cars right from the jump. You know, I would sit and read the classifieds in the local newspaper, looking at what cars were for sale. You know, we would be on a road trip, and I'd be naming every car that went by our window. You know, much to the amusement and then frustration of my parents, because nothing makes a 4-hour drive feel like a 9-hour drive quite like a kid naming every car that drives by. But you know, they encouraged me, and they were always, even if they didn't quite understand what it was that I saw in cars, they were always encouraging me to learn more about them and to tinker with them and to understand them. And they really, you know, they really fostered my interest in it, even if it wasn't an interest that I got from either of them. And it's cool because now I think that gives me a good perspective, because a lot of the people who write about cars and make, you know, are in automotive media are people who grew up in car families. There are a lot of second generation car writers and car bloggers and car video people out there who are only talking to the people who already love cars. And what I like to do with my stuff, even writing for a niche publication like Road & Track, I like to think of it from the terms of, you know, how accessible is this to somebody who's not already a diehard car freak? Because I think that's important, and I think that it's possible for somebody who doesn't love cars obsessively to find something interesting in cars, or to enjoy the act of driving, or appreciate the design of a really good-looking car. So that's what I kind of go for, and I think that growing up in a household where we weren't just talking about cars all the time helped to instill that perspective in me, because at the end of the day, whenever I'm writing something about a car, I think to myself, well, what makes this understandable to my mom and dad, who both appreciate cool cars but aren't sitting there going, oh, well, this car has 440 horsepower, but this one has 450. You know, they're not zoomed in on that level. And so I try and capture that in my writing. I try and make it accessible to people like that.
It's a very good point, because if you just circle the wagons and don't accept anyone else into the, you know, clan or whatever, then no one, you're all going to die out. It's just going to, no one else, no one new is going to be allowed in. It's just going to be who was in, and it's going to slowly diminish over time. Whereas, you know, like, let's say, like, dressage, for example. Like, probably not a bunch of people growing up with horses that dance, but, you know, the people who are into that probably, probably not the most welcoming and inviting to newcomers as well, not an easy hobby to get into. And that'll probably die out fairly, by the end of our lifetime, dressage probably won't be a thing anymore. So,
yeah.
Do we go the way of dressage, or do we go, you know, I'm trying to think of like a, like horse racing, like circuit track racing for horses, where maybe you don't quite follow it all year, but there's a few big events and everyone gets invited in. And if you want to dress up like a crazy person and put on a big ass blue hat and go join the club, then go do that. And you don't really need to know all the ins and outs. Like, let's be more like racing, like horse racing, than like dressage, I guess. So,
yeah, absolutely. And I think that we as younger car enthusiasts have almost a duty to do this, because what I see as the biggest problem that faces car enthusiasm is the lopsided focus on cars that our parents grew up with, you know. So you go to any auction, you go to any car event, you turn on any TV network that has car content on it, and what do you see? You see 60s and 70s muscle cars. It's all Mustangs and Camaros and Mopar muscle cars. And the fact that this conversation seems to be so dominated by one genre of cars, I think, is off-putting to people who aren't inherently interested in those cars. And I think those cars are great, but, you know, when you go to the auto shows and you know, Ford has a 60s Mustang on its stand, and Chrysler has, you know, the Challenger that looks exactly like the old Challenger, and Chevy's got a vintage Chevy pickup on their stand, it's almost a way of saying, you know, we're not interested in attracting anybody who's not interested in these things. And I think that's off-putting, you know. I think that there's a lot of incredibly cool stuff that's being done out there in modern cars, and if the car media could take off its blinders to what's new and what's cutting edge and what's never been done before, I think that that would be the greatest thing we could do to help preserve car culture in the 21st century.
Yeah, I think it might have even been a Road and Track article I'm thinking about, where it was a V or the turbocharged Camaro versus the turbocharged Mustang, and kind of proving the point that you don't have to have the V8 to have fun. Like, even that fact that, like,
right,
you know, there's people out there who are like, well, you got a Mustang, but it's not really a Mustang because it's got an inline four in it. It's like, this has 300 horsepower, which is more than the original Mustang came with, and it gets good gas mileage,
exactly,
and I can still have fun. Like, what's wrong with that? And
right, and you have to think about, like, if the Mustang and Camaro never existed before, and Chevy and Ford both sat down today in 2018 to come up with a two-door performance car aimed at young buyers, what they would draw would be nothing like the Camaro and Mustang we have today. And I love the Camaro, and I love the Mustang, and I love the Challenger as portly and as you know, purposefully retro as it is. But it makes you wonder what great ideas are we missing out on because we're so focused on rehashing the past. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit disappointing to think about. It's a little bit disheartening. I mean, I'm looking at the latest cover of Road and Track magazine, and there's a Porsche 911 on it. I love the 911. It's a fantastic car. A lot of what defines that car was designed with the original 911 in the early 1960s.
Yeah.
But what else could Porsche do if they started with a clean slate? And that's what I find really fascinating about Tesla, because Tesla really is the only automaker that is starting with a clean slate. By definition, you know, Tesla wasn't around more than 10 years ago. So, you know, I think a lot of the fact a lot of the reason why Tesla looks so revolutionary is simply because they're not tied to anything in the past, and they don't feel like they have to rehash old ideas in order to keep their customers interested.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny you say Tesla, because the first one that popped into my mind was actually Kia, of all brands, because they make some great stuff, especially like the Stinger is fantastic, and there's no real, you know, clinging on to a legacy, because Kia's legacy before this is, if you told anyone in the early 90s, hey, I'm thinking of, I'm going to go cross shop a Kia and an Audi, and they didn't tackle you and bring you to an insane asylum for going to those brands, then you didn't have good friends. But you know, Kia just...
Exactly.
Yeah. So they get this wonderful clean slate, and I mean, the little hatchback they make that I can't think of right now, the little GT version of it, is probably better than a Focus ST, but no one's really paying attention to them in the press because, well, it's just a Kia. You know, it's good.
Yeah, and and that's a really sneaky thing because, you know, we just saw at the Detroit Auto Show, Hyundai surprised the world with the
Veloster. Yeah.
And so they've got this new performance Veloster, and nobody knew it was coming. There was no advance information given out to any of the motor press. And the car that they showed on the stand, the more you look at it and the closer you look at it, the more you realize that this is a car for gearheads. It's manual only. It's got a hydroelectric LSD. I think it's the only limited slip differential of that design available in something that's not, you know, $60,000 or more.
Yeah.
And no sunroof, cloth interior, a pretty simple dash. You know, there's not a huge, giant touchscreen on the dashboard. This is a gearhead car. This is the car that everybody says they want. You know, the bare-bones car with minimal options and maximum drivetrain and stick, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool to see that, and yeah, your point is well made. Like, who on earth would have expected this from the Korean automaker?
Yeah, and they have this benefit of, like you were saying, they don't have to cling to anything in the past. They just get to go, here's something new, we hope you like it. And I mean, it's worked for them, and it's fantastic. And, you know, the only thing that's probably holding them back is the fact that people still look at them and go, well, they're kind of the cheap brand still, aren't they? Because we hear Audi and we think, oh, Audi, wonderful brand, super expensive, worth it, though, German built, German luxury. But Audi was a joke longer than Kia was a joke in terms of, like, cars just catching fire or unintended acceleration. But, you know, now it's... Audi gets to make an R8, and if Kia came out or Hyundai came out with it, what would the reaction really be? I mean, it would be kind of like, well, who wants a supercar from Hyundai of all people? So,
exactly. Yeah. It would be like, all right, stay in your lane, guys. Keep making cheap cars. The really fascinating thing for me is thinking about the era when people talked this way about Honda and Toyota. And that's, you know, that was long before I was born. By the time I was aware of cars in the late 80s and early 90s, Toyota and Honda had already established their dominance. But there was a time not that long ago when people looked at cars from Honda, cars from Toyota, cars from Datsun, which turned into Nissan, and said to themselves, oh, what is this rinky-dink bullshit, you know? And now these are the most powerful automakers on earth, and they make the majority of cars on American roads, you know, passenger cars, not counting pickup trucks. So it'll be fascinating to see, you know, whether the Korean automakers can parallel that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what's kind of the sign of all that is a Datsun 240 is worth more money than a similar vintage Porsche 924 or 944. You know, all...
Isn't that outrageous?
Yeah, and if you would have told someone in the 70s that, they'd be like, oh, that'll never happen. Like, no, it's going to happen, and it's going to be not even close. So,
I love to try and think about this, where if the vintage car market stays as strong as it is right now, 30 years down the road, what are the outrageously pricey collectible cars going to be? I think it's a fun thought experiment, because you've got the cars that are pricey and valuable and sought after because of what they represent. You know, Porsche 911s are like that. You know, 911 values have always been decent and now are getting really, really, really high. But then you have the oddball stuff, you know. So the 240Z is a perfect example, where they made millions of them. They were thought of as a disposable car. They were an affordable sports car for young people, and most people had them as their only car. They daily drove them, winter, summer, you know, snow, rain, and when they wore out, they junked them. Yep. So now they've got this sort of hallowed status because they're fantastic to drive, and because they're, you know, they're simple enough and solidly built that you could even today drive one every day. But it's exactly like you said. If you told somebody in 1974, hey, you know, put that 240Z in the barn and make sure it stays in good condition, it'll pay for your kid's college someday, you'd get looked at like you were crazy.
I'm gonna have to pay for college? What's this malarkey?
Yeah, you'd have to start by explaining that college tuition prices have gone up exorbitantly.
Yeah. Well, to that point, I do think, you know, the reason why comic book prices were ridiculously expensive in the early 90s was because they all got thrown out because they were garbage. And so the people who wanted them were fighting over such a small quantity. And then that whole market collapsed because of everyone was buying super special collector's editions of everything. And then those all ended up being worth nothing. So if you take that and you parallel that into the automotive world, you know, I bet you in 30 years' time, my Ford Fiesta, as long as I keep it, will be worth probably more than a similar vintage Mustang GT or even probably a Boss 302. Because there'll probably be most of the Boss 302s left on the road. It's probably going to be like 5 or 6 people who are crazy enough to keep around a Fiesta ST or even a Focus ST.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but that is, you know, you make a good point there. And it's you think about the cars that were enjoyed but not pampered when they were new. Those are the cars that are going to be super valuable. And, you know, I think a big part of why Mustangs and Camaros and Mopar muscle cars are so strong on the market today is because those were the cars that baby boomers loved and wanted to have when they were new cars. So now you get people who are a little bit older, who have a little bit of money stored away. What do they want to buy? They want to buy the car that they lusted after when it was new and when they were young. So I don't know. I don't know what those cars are today. You know, I think, you know, Corvettes will always have a good value. Porsches will always have a good value. But, you know, I spend so much time among super nerdy gearheads. I'm not really sure what cars the average person is lusting after today, the average young person. I would imagine that in 20 or 30 years, you're going to see the values of WRXs and STIs and Mitsubishi Evos go up. Maybe, you know, Nissan 350Zs and 370Zs. You know, we're already seeing that with super values, but it's fascinating to think about. I was having a conversation at the Detroit Auto Show this week. Somebody brought up, you remember the Chrysler Aspen?
Was that a trim level or was that an actual car?
It was a vehicle. It was an actual model. It was a Chrysler badged Dodge Durango. This was like
I think
like 2006 to 2008. It had a short run, but even more obscure than that is the Chrysler Aspen Hybrid, which Dodge put out in I think 2008, right around the time when gas prices were going crazy. because they wanted to try a luxury hybrid three-row SUV. And I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but it was a model that had only like a 1 or 2 year run. And there can only be, the numbers are probably only in the several thousands that they built. And I have a sneaking suspicion that that is going to be the Edsel of the Barrett Jackson auctions in, 2065.
Mm-hmm.
Because they built so few of them, and it was such a half-hearted, lackluster attempt at a hybrid. And then they just canned the whole model, 2 years in. I don't know. I think vehicles like that have an oddball history are going to be the sneaky value of Barrett Jackson, if there even is such a thing as Barrett Jackson in the year 2065.
Yeah. Well, Velocity will still be running reruns no matter what. So
we're going to be on the 700th season of Counting Cars.
Yeah. Like, didn't these guys die like decades ago? Yeah, they recorded a bunch, though, before they passed. Like, okay, keep it coming.
I'm just waiting for the day when one of these shows is on so long that they have to restore one of their own project cars. It's like, yeah, remember in 2002 when we built this Superbird? Well, it's a rusty Hulk now, and we have to rebuild it again. But oh no, we've only got 3 days before the auction. Can we make it? Find out next time.
The answer is always yes, and it's because you have a team of people working behind the scenes who are actually putting the car together. So
exactly. I remember before I started in the writing world, I was looking at job listings, and there was a job listing for a writer for a reality unscripted TV show. And just let that wash over you for a second. Writer for an unscripted TV show. That sort of took away some of the magic of it for me. So yeah, it's I don't know. You can set your watch by when in the episode there is, the big argument about, well, we're not going to make it if this doesn't happen, and then they cut to a commercial break.
Yep. I forget, what's the gentleman who's in charge of Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Larry David.
Larry David. Larry David. He was saying he was having food, like at a cafe diner somewhere in New York, and the production crew from the Kim Kardashian show, or one of the Real Housewives shows, I'm not quite sure which, but they like came in, like shut down the place, and he was just watching them work, and it's like, they came in, they fed them lines, they told them we're going to hit this beat, this beat, this beat, here's what you say then, this is what you're going to say in the hidden camera and all that, and he said his quote-unquote scripted show had so much less actual script and dialogue to it than watching this, quote, reality show. And it's like, it's this world is upside down. We don't, scripted's less scripted than unscripted. Nothing makes sense anymore. So,
so crazy, yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of the problem I have with a lot of stuff with the reality TV and the car world. And I'm curious then, so you're a consumer of media then, and this is a little bit on the spot then, but what is your automotive show du jour? Like, what is it that you sit down and watch?
My favorite car stuff to watch is old episodes of the British car flip guy. What is the name of the show?
Wheeler Dealers?
Wheeler Dealers. So, before they got the budget, before they, would travel to the U.S. do entire seasons in the U.S., when it was just Ed in his little one-stall garage with his two-post car lift fixing up an old BMW and turning $3,000 profit on it, I love that show just because it's so much about the cars. There's no drama. There's very little When they go to buy the car or sell the car and they're bargaining on price, that feels a little bit scripted. But for the most part, it's just like, we pulled off the wheel and there's a bad wheel bearing, so better take the bad one out and put the good one in. And it's soothing. The other show that I could always watch is sort of mid-year's Top Gear. So, you know, Clarkson, Hammond, and May, but before, let's say, I would say before 2012, because they were still working hard. They were still trying to define what this show meant for them. And, you know, to be honest, I started watching the Grand Tour when it first came out. It's not compelling enough for me to set my calendar, you know, to set an alert to remember to watch the new episodes when they come out. It's just because it's disappointing. They have all the money in the world. They have all the Amazon money that they could possibly want. And what are they doing? They're rehashing all of the old jokes and all of the old storylines and all of the old gags that they did on Top Gear when they were on BBC. Mm-hmm. It just feels like three guys who figured out the formula and they're never going to have an original thought again. And that's disappointing because what they created on the BBC was in a lot of ways really beautiful and really compelling. I mean, that is a show, whenever I'm visiting my parents at home, I could turn on an episode of Top Gear and everybody ends up on the couch watching the show, you know, and my siblings who are not interested in cars the way that I am find something compelling in it. My mom, who's a designer, can find something compelling in the shapes of these cars and the way that they're shot and the videography, the cinematography of it. It was a show that was compelling even if you had no interest in cars, and I don't think the new show has that.
No, it's I was very much thinking of the, you know, I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed bit of it, where, like, they'll do stuff that's obviously fake, and, you know, you don't want to be lied to as a viewer, where, like, they had the recent episode where they did the, they were filling up the cars with gas, like, remotely, so, and then they just would show the car blowing up. It's like, well, that obviously didn't happen with, you know, Richard Hammond in there, so, like, it's just don't lie to us. And like when Clarkson was just calling James May a vagina over and over again, it's like, you're one of the best writers on the planet. You can come up with a better insult than vagina. Like, come on, like, work, like, you have the money, you have the time, just do something. Like, why are you doing this? But whatever. But
I think it's just a matter of, you know, first of all, these guys are a little bit older and they're caught in a certain type of humor. Humor ages quicker than any other form of communication, you know?
Yeah.
You watch a comedy movie from 20 years ago, and the style, the delivery, the type of jokes that are being told are completely different from today. And these guys are, by and large, humor writers. You know, they do a show that has a big element of humor to it. And, you know, it's not about how old they are. It's about how they got to a certain point and they decided not to develop it any further.
Yep.
And it feels like a trope. You know, it feels like, I don't know, it feels like one of the last seasons of Happy Days where you know, the dialogue just turns into Fonzie going, "Hey," a lot.
Yeah. Well, to bring it to a happier note then, this is me plugging other people's work. Have you seen Project Binky on YouTube by any chance?
I haven't. I'm not even familiar with what it is.
I will send you a link when we get done here. It's two British guys in a shed building a four-wheel drive Mini. And it's basically like 90% fabrication and like 10% humor, and it just works. And it's fantastic. And it's like 30-minute long episodes. They come out like once a year, but it's so worth it just to sit down and watch it. So I'll send you a link.
That sounds really cool, actually.
Yeah, no, it's phenomenal. And, like, my wife, who doesn't get cars at all, she's like, they're funny, but why did they got to build so much stuff? Like, well, that's the whole point. So,
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So let me ask you then, you know, you're somebody who's involved in the car media. What would you like to see that you're not seeing in car media right now, whether that's in magazines, online, on video, on television? What like, what is the gap that you think is not being filled?
I think there just needs to be more Ike on all platforms. I think that's really what needs to be. That'll fix everything.
We'll just get a 24-hour Ike channel.
Yeah, I mean, my time might be a little bit boring, but other than that, it'll be great. we'll pre-record some dream segments. Anytime it's, you know, a couple guys doing something they like to do, whether it's putting together a car, whether it's going on road trips, if it's competing, whatever it is, that's always the most compelling to me is when you, because another good podcast to talk about, the Team Clear Coat guys, they talk about how it's not that it's so much a story about cars, it's about the story of friendship as told through cars. Like, that's what really makes this stuff compelling. And
exactly.
Like, when it's fake drama, when it's fake whatever put onto it, the moment I can tell you're lying to me, I'm done. I'm out. And I think that's what made those middle years of Top Gear so great. Like, when they're in Botswana or the South African rainforest or South American rainforest and they're, you know, the cars show up and, like, the ones, like, Jace May goes, like, my car was blue in the advert and now it's red. It's like, well, like, I don't think you could script that. That's something that's the case. Like, I don't think you're lying to me when you say that. And even when there's those exaggerations or they do something stupid and silly just for the camera, it's told from such a honest place that it's like, I can't tell if you're lying to me or not, so I'm just going to give you the benefit of the doubt. And that's...
Exactly. So, it's... Yeah, and there was a strange moment. So I started watching this most recent season of the Grand Tour, and they made a big deal of talking about how one of the episodes this season is unscripted.
Yep.
And I heard that and I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then I started thinking about it a little more and I'm like, wait a minute. If this one's unscripted, that means all the other ones were scripted. And I was getting madder and madder just sitting there thinking to myself, these sons of bitches, they lied to me because they work so hard to make it seem candid. And, you have to assume that most of it is scripted because, you know, stuff doesn't happen in real life the way it happens on that TV show. But when they admit it and when they say, we're going to do a show without that, like... Ooh, it's something about it. It's like, it's as if, imagine pro wrestling. Imagine if WWE came out and said, we're going to have a special and we're not going to pretend, you know? It's like, the longer you think about it, the more infuriating it is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that's the best analogy ever because it's, we all know it's fake, but you don't need to tell us while we're watching. Like, it's just like...
Right.
Like, oh, the Punisher's going to win. Like, well, I kind of wanted to watch, but now all the drama's been taken out of it. Like, is the Punisher a wrestler? I never watched wrestling. Or is that a comic character?
Your guess is as good as mine, Ike. It sounds like a good name.
Sure. Like, why not? Like, that'll be my wrestling name if it's not taken. So we've gone way off the rails of the scripted stuff here, you know, our scripted questions since we're talking about that. But I find this a fascinating thing, and I don't want to. I know you're a busy man, and we're kind of at our hour point here. But I'm very fascinated to know what, if you have time, of course, like what the car you learned to drive on was.
So, okay. I grew up in a Jeep family. My mom always had Jeeps. Once she got rid of her Camaro that she brought me home from the hospital in, she always had Jeeps, so we lived out in the suburbs, and so late at night, my dad and I would go out for a drive, and I was, you know, 12 or 13 years old, and we'd get out to an abandoned country road, and he'd let me slide behind the wheel. So the first car that I ever drove was a 89 Jeep Cherokee XJ with the 4-liter straight six, the greatest engine known to man. But as far as my first car that I drove legally, I had a 2002 Jeep Liberty. And, you know, it's embarrassing to admit, but my parents bought it for me when I was in high school. And it was right when the Liberty first came out, and I had one of the first lifted Jeep Liberties in North America. I had a 3-inch lift kit and 32-inch tires on it, and it looked really cool, actually. You know, jacked up a little bit, and with a bit of a bigger tire in it, it looked really aggressive. Or at least I thought when I was in high school and college. And I kept that car until I was in medical school, and then it got handed down to my brother and handed down to my sister and handed down to my other brother. The family got rid of that car, I think, 2 years ago. So it's from 2002 to 2016. It was in the family for 14 or 15 years. So that was the car that I started driving in. Not a sporty car, but you know, I've always liked Jeeps. I've always liked 4x4s. So you know, that's my origin story.
Well, where were you living when you owned this thing?
So I grew up outside of Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Okay, so putting that into the little mental checker there of if it makes you feel better, mine was a Saturn. So that around the same time, so it could have been much worse. So
remember Saturn?
Yeah, I do. I actually miss my Saturn a lot. Like I should never have sold it. It's the most reliable car I've ever owned. It did do the ignition thing on me a couple times, and I didn't know enough about cars to realize that was something wrong with it. But
I'm glad that you weren't one of the many fatalities.
I was literally, well, the first time it ever happened to me, I was just driving down the highway, hit a big bump, car turns off, so I go, put the key back in, start it back up, put it back into dry, or you know, turn it back onto the ignition point, and then pull the key out and just put it on the passenger seat. And that's how I drove from then on, is I would put the key in, start it, and then pull the key out. And my brother's like, you shouldn't be able to do that. Like, oh, what do you know about cars? Like,
right. You're like, because that's the thing. When you're a teenager and you think you know everything about cars, you can convince yourself that the stupidest thing is smart, you know? Like, I remember times when like, you know, I'd be driving around with my mom or my dad in the passenger seat, and I would be manually shifting the automatic transmission, you know. And this was before paddle shifters. This was before every car had, you know, a sequential shifting pattern. So I'm driving, you know, my mom's 95 Grand Cherokee, which has, you know, drive, an overdrive off button, second gear and first gear. It's a 4-speed automatic. And I'm sitting there shifting through the gears, and my mom is like, Bob, this is idiotic. Why on earth are you doing this? There's a reason why we invented automatic transmissions. And I'm like, no, Mom, you need the torque. I was such an idiot.
But that's how you learn that you're stupid. And then once you accept that you're stupid when it comes to cars, then you can truly embrace being an enthusiast. So,
and that's when you get the job.
Exactly. So I'm surprised to hear Jeep outside of Scranton, Pennsylvania, didn't end in a fiery rollover crash, especially with the lift kit. So,
got plenty close.
Yeah. Well, of course. I mean, it had to. I'm assuming the first time was on ice.
Oh, there was a lot of that. There was a lot of snow-covered parking lot shenanigans. My Jeep did not have ABS. It did not have any kind of traction control or stability control, and it had open differentials front and rear. So, of course, you know, being 17 and invincible, whenever it would snow, I would go out and trundle around in the snow thinking that I was, you know, impervious to getting stuck. I had some close calls in that car, and actually my first and so far only real accident was in that car. I was driving around with a Russian exchange student who it was her first day in the United States, and we were on our way to school that morning, on our way to high school, and I got into a T-bone wreck. And I looked over to this hapless Russian exchange student in the passenger seat, and I go, oh, are you all right? She goes, yeah, I'm fine. And then she sort of looks at me and she goes, it is my first car accident. And I'm thinking, oh, God, she's gonna send an email back to her parents in Russia. And she's going to say, I was in this country for 12 hours and we got in a car accident.
I just, That is not how the story I expected. Like, so I was in my Jeep with a Russian exchange student. It was her first day in the U.S. And I'm like, you know how we say hello in the United States? Like, no, tell me. My first. And that's how I ended up with my first kid. Yeah. It's a way of showing love in the United States. Like, beep, beep, T-bone.
Yeah. Look how well we drive here.
Yeah. Like, oh, obviously one of you was drunk on vodka, right? That's how we do it in my country. No, not quite the same here. So, oh my goodness. So, I'm going to have to get you back on the show, Bob. You are a fascinating gentleman, just like I thought you would be. I'm glad you overcame your hatred of podcasts to come join me on this podcast this afternoon. So, you know,
we're going to call this a radio show, just so that I don't have to renege on my dislike of podcasts. So here's the thing: it's not that I dislike all podcasts. What I dislike is the podcasts where it's the same people on every week and they talk about the same things. It's just like listening into a bar conversation. So stuff like this, where you talk to interesting people about interesting things, and it's not just, you know, rehashing the same jokes over and over, this is good. And that's why I will, in my own mind, think of this as a radio show that just happens to be beamed onto your smartphone.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, as someone who's been doing this for, God, how long have I been doing this now? 3-4 years now? It's been a while. That's ridiculous to think about. You know, I've heard a lot of podcasts. I know it's crazy me to think about, like, well, when it's just me talking into, you know, a microphone back in the day, and we're me and my buddy back when we started it up, it's not quite a lot of people listen to it back then, not like now. So it's, you know, I've heard a lot of bad podcasts out there, and I agree with you that there are a lot more bad ones than good ones, but I can send you a list of decent ones, you know, but I think kind of like the Hulk, at the end of the day, the secret is that we're all really bad. It's just different levels of it. So
that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. So, Bob, where can we find you? Obviously, we could go to rodentrack.com and look at you there, right? Like, that, read all your articles there.
Yes, please click on every link on rodentrack.com. I am also on Twitter at rsorokanich. R for Robert, for Bob, mm-hmm. and then my last name. That's also my handle on Instagram. And Facebook, don't look for me on Facebook. Yeah, but it's been a real pleasure being on the show with you, Ike. Been a real interesting conversation, and I hope to do it again sometime soon.
Right, excellent. I got to get you back because there's still a bunch of other mysteries of your life that we have to sort out. But unfortunately, I'm sure you're a little busy, and I got to go figure out why my toddler's destroying her room. So, you know.
Feels like a good place to end it.
Exactly. So, everyone go check out Road and Track. Bob, I'm going to say goodbye to you off air, and everyone listening, I'll be right back with you. Thank you for listening to today's program. If you like what you hear, make sure to tell a friend, a loved one, or a coworker. Make sure you leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen to this. It really helps out a lot. You can follow the show on all social media at Untitled Car Show. And thanks so much for listening. Have a good night. Have a good evening. Wherever you are, whatever time it is there. Thank you so much for listening. Please be safe out there.